Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and let's continue this conversation about the economy and some of the indicators that are kind of jumping all over the place right now. Gold is at $1,400 an ounce. China is downgrading the U.S. government debt rating. The Fed buys $600 billion of its own government bonds, and other G20 nations rebel. The stock market is at a two-year high amidst all of this. Yes, the most common economic indicators are a jumble of conflicting arrows. We will talk now with Glenn Hubbard, the dean of the Columbia Business School and a member of the Bush administration economic team, and Peter Navarro, a business professor at UC Irvine, who was endorsed by Bill Clinton in a congressional run. They have a book together, the premise of which is that they come from different political backgrounds, but generally agree on a center-right economic criticism of all things Obama. It's called The Seeds of Economic Destruction, Why the Path to Economic Ruin Runs Through Washington, and How to Reclaim American Prosperity. Glenn Hubbard, Peter Navarro, thank you very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Yeah, great to be here.
And before we get to the premise of the book, I wonder if the two of you would run through some of the headlines with us and give us your thoughts on them. Chinese credit agencies have downgraded the U.S. debt rating, and I gather it's not the first time. This is the big fear of a lot of people, that China, which kind of keeps the U.S. afloat at this point, at least the U.S. government, will say, no, this isn't a good investment for us anymore. Glenn Hubbard, what does it mean?
Well, I think it's part of a broader story. You know, the current mindset in Washington is we need to do a series of short-term fixes, and then we'll get to the long-term. The problem is it's long-term structural problems that got us into this mess, one of which is fiscal, the budget problem that you mentioned, but there are others in terms of the structure of our economy. The best thing we could do to help the short-term is to right the long-term ship. And so in that sense, the Chinese are shedding a light on a very important problem. They, too, have to do some big structural changes. Both they and we need to pivot.
And Peter Navarro, you write in the book that the Obama administration's failure to confront trade partners like China has created a chronic trade imbalance and destroyed American jobs. So what would you like to see the policy toward China be that it isn't?
Well, first of all, I think we have to understand that when we run chronic trade deficits, we're shaving points off our growth rate and costing jobs. If we lose a half a percentage point a year, the Chinese trade surpluses, we're basically losing half a million jobs. What I would like to see in the broader context of the G20 meeting now, as they're going to be meeting in Seoul, Korea, is breaking the peg between the U.S. dollar and the Chinese yuan. The problem is with China pegging that their currency to ours, it's impossible for us to reduce our deficit through currency adjustments, which is the normal free market adjustment. So this whole thing about China raising our credit spreads because of risk, the bigger strategic game is Ben Bernanke at the Fed and the Chinese central bank are involved in this lock-torn battle over breaking the peg. And that's what the bigger story is there. China basically is once again threatening us when, in fact, they need to also engage in these structural forms that Glenn Hubbard's talking about.
And, Glenn, can you explain that phrase a little bit more, breaking the peg? What does it mean for one country's currency to be pegged to another's?
Well, it means that the Chinese currency moves in lockstep with the dollar. So as Peter was saying, that normally when you have market adjustments, exchange rates move and trade patterns change. But China has chosen to keep an undervalued exchange rate. It conducts its monetary policy to make that possible. China does this because it wants an economy that's promoted by exports. A better answer for China, and one where I think China would like to head, is an economy that's more centered on domestic demand and domestic consumption. The U.S., by contrast, needs to focus much more on investment and net exports. Those are the long-term changes that these two economies have to make.
And I think it's important to point out that in the process of pegging their currency to ours, what they do is they recycle our dollars back into our government bond market, effectively
Correct.
Financing our deficit and pushing down our interest rates. It's a stalemate right now, and this gambit by Bernanke to engage in QE2 to essentially devalue the dollar puts enormous pressure on China because it devalues all of the reserves they hold. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but they hold over $1 trillion of our money in their reserves. So this is high stakes poker, and all the other countries at the G20 have a stake in this game because whether it's Brazil or India or Korea or Japan, they're all experiencing upward pressure on their currencies because of what both China and the Federal Reserve of the United States is doing.
And for people who don't know the shorthand that he just used, QE2, which used to refer to a cruise ship or a British monarch, now actually...
Well, it's kind of like a cruise ship in the sense that, you know, on a cruise ship, you can wind up eating too much. And that's one of the potential problems in quantitative easing. Quantitative easing just means the Federal Reserve buying longer-term assets, long-term U.S. bonds, with an attempt to push down their yield and push up asset prices. That's essentially what Chairman Bernanke and his colleagues are doing.
And buying a lot of them, $600 billion worth. And listeners,
it's a lot.
Go ahead.
It's a lot, but I think the effect is likely to be modest. You know, even if the Fed bought $1 trillion worth, I think most economists would say maybe 20 to 30 basis points off the 10-year yield. That's really not the core issue in the American economy.
In other words, interest rates in the private economy won't go down that much that it'll make a difference in investment?
It'll make some difference, and it will certainly raise asset prices a bit, but it also comes with risks that inflationary expectations change and that markets start to worry more about inflation. It's not a free lunch, and Chairman Bernanke has admitted such.
You say raise
And I think the broader picture here is basically that the Fed, the White House, and the Congress are fighting this economic battle as if it were simply a short-term cyclical downturn.
Exactly.
Using the typical Keynesian stimulus of printing more money and spending more money, when in fact, as Glenn and I point out, we have a longer-term structural problem that actually goes back to the beginning of the decade, where we've grown systematically below our potential output because of excess consumption and government spending and too little business investment, the key driver of job creation, and too big trade deficits. So, you know, what Glenn and I talk about is the need not for more Keynesian stimulus, but rather for tax reform, trade reform, regulatory reform, and the like to stimulate the right parts of our GDP growth equation.
Glenn Hubbard and Peter Navarro with us, authors of Seeds of Destruction, Why the Path to Economic Ruin Runs Through Washington, and How to Reclaim American Prosperity. And we can take a few phone calls for them or web comments at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or you can call us up right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And, Peter, I guess another repercussion from currency being, in effect, devalued, the dollar being devalued through this QE2, is gold, the price of gold spiking. And you write in the book about preventing the next housing bubble and the next financial collapse. Are you worried at all about a gold bubble, or other commodities are going up too? A general commodities bubble being the next big bubble problem?
You know, that's a great question, because historically, the primary reason why gold has risen has been because of the presence of actual inflation. And what we have instead with gold going up is countries around the world seeing the dollar going essentially into the toilet and looking for a different type of reserve currency. So the central banks of India and China and elsewhere are actually buying gold as foreign exchange, making essentially the gold the new de facto reserve currency of the world. And that's why it's going up. And that should be a very, very troubling sign to everybody, because what it means is that all the money that we're printing here in the U.S., that Europe's printing, and other countries are printing, is going to lead at some point to this huge round of inflation.
Well, and there's another issue in a bubble, which is in government bonds themselves. You know, long-term nominal government bonds pose a real risk because of the inflation risk that Peter mentions. And I think many bond market participants are worried about a bubble in an asset that we typically tell the public is, quote, safe.
Glenn, you were part of President Bush's economics team. Your book is called Seeds of Destruction, Why the Path to Economic Ruin Runs Through Washington. Did it run through the Bush administration's economic policies at all, in your opinion, with hindsight?
I think it did. You know, I give President Bush a great deal of credit for much of his pro-growth policies and certainly many of his tax policies. But on the spending side, some of the problems that we've encountered in the past decade had their seeds, frankly, in spending that the Bush administration acquiesced to, and in particular, the very large Medicare expansion. While President Obama has certainly been a very big spender by that standard, I don't think you can escape blame in the Bush administration.
Eli in Toms River, you're on WNYC. Hello, Eli.
Yeah, hi. In terms of the government, you know, devaluing the currency, so they printed so much money to prop up the stock market artificially, but I would assume that at current rates at about 11,000, it's not really worth much more than it was at 7,000, considering that in order to prop it up, they had to devalue the currency.
You know, I love that point because what you're basically saying is correct. We look like we're in a bull uptrend right now, but when you discount for the fall in the currency, it turns much flatter. And so, if you're kind of an investor or a trader, you really need to be mindful of that. The other thing that's happening, and it goes back to Brian's point about a possible commodity bubble, there's a fixed inverse relationship between the value of the dollar and commodities and energy, because commodities and energy worldwide are priced in dollars. So whenever the dollar goes down, that stuff's got to go up. And none of that is good for the world economy when the prices of commodities and energy rise. That's contractionary.
Well, explain the connection between the quantitative easing, the Fed's buying $600 billion of Treasury bonds, and the stock market going up in the last week, because the stock market apparently loves this. Why is that so?
Well, okay. Well, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, what quantitative easing does is essentially, you know, the Fed is buying government bonds and crediting reserves there. And so some of that money that's now credited spills over into other assets, including stocks. But the run-up in stock prices from quantitative easing is likely to be relatively modest. It'll have a modest effect on consumption. And the risk of quantitative easing is very high.
And James in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Yes.
James, hi.
Hi. It seems to me, my memory is correct here, that we were on the right path in the early 2000s and the late 1990s when the Clinton administration managed to get rid of the Republican deficit spending of the 1980s and 90s. I mean, that sounds odd even to say it, Republican deficit spending, when you think of them historically being the fiscally prudent party. But they really sort of dug us into this hole. And also the Clinton emphasis on putting people first, in other words, investing in people for long-term productivity growth. We were on the right path, and then the Bush administration, the Republicans, came in and got rid of those surpluses, and they thought that was a good thing, and that was just sheer craziness. And then they really had no interest in investing in people in terms of education, which is the only place our problems are going to be resolved. I mean, our long-term pension problems are going to be resolved by investing in young people today, because they will have to pay for the pensions of us who are retired 20, 30 years from now.
I think some conservatives would disagree with you and say one of the failings of the Bush administration, according to them, is that they passed this big No Child Left Behind law and invested more in federal education spending.
Well, no, that's not where they spent the money. They spent the money on that, drugs prescription and a few other domestic programs, which is odd. I mean, that's another thing that we simply have to go back to, the idea that we had adopted in the late 1990s. They called it PAYGO. The idea is very simple, is that if you all agree, if the politicians all agree, well, we want to spend X dollars, well, then you must. I mean, we need to maybe change the institution so that once you've decided to spend X dollars, well, then that's how many dollars the tax system has to raise, period.
If I could comment both on your institutions.
You're both chopping at the bit. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, the institutions and the history. On the institutions, I couldn't agree more. We need a mechanism that reins in growth and entitlement spending. That's really where all the dollars are in the long term. And we need PAYGO to really restrict domestic discretionary spending. The history is a little more complicated than the caller makes it sound. President Bush 43's father, President Bush 41, actually had the first and most courageous budget bill in the 90s. It cost him his job, actually. And President Clinton was forced to sign a balanced budget act that came from a Republican Congress. But it is certainly true that rapid growth in the 1990s did lead to higher surpluses. And therein lies part of the lesson in our book, that we need to return to a better balanced growth path and spending restraint rather than just pointing fingers at the two parties.
But does supply side work? Haven't we seen 30 years of experience that says tax cuts for the rich do not trickle down to the working people of America or produce more government revenue through faster growth? Reagan cut taxes and had to raise them again when his deficits exploded. Clinton raised taxes and we had those boom times anyway. Bush cut taxes and we had total wage stagnation except at the highest incomes. And then the result in the last couple of years. What does that history tell us, in your opinion, Glenn?
Well, I think that history tells us that you have to tell the story in a richer way than your question asks, because lots of things were moving at the same time. I think it's almost a truism in economics that pro-growth, simple tax policies will have the highest effect on long-term economic growth and potential. We don't really use the tax system to try to time the economy, but we have to have a tax system that's geared to the size of government. I personally would like to see a smaller government and a simpler tax system. If the American people actually want the kind of government President Obama has suggested, we're going to have to raise a lot of taxes.
And yet I just want to follow up because, Glenn, you wrote an op-ed in September in the Wall Street Journal, which said that President Obama was starting to get it in terms of tax policy. What did you have in mind there?
In one respect, President Obama had moved toward investment incentives. Remember, one of the themes that Peter and I are talking about in the book is trying to support business investment better. President Obama had rejected that when he first took office, but then suggested he was more open to it. Lately, he's been more open to free trade. He'd been opposed to free trade before. Now he's in favor. These are good developments, and we should celebrate them.
Peter, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I think it's important to move past this rhetoric of tax cuts. I mean, Glenn and I, in treating this issue, reject the idea of just cut taxes. What we need is more fundamental structural tax reform, which shifts us from kind of an income tax-based system to a more consumption tax-based system that rewards savings and investment. Because the real goal, Brian, in terms of tax reform, is to stimulate that domestic investment component of our growth equation. And right now, the fact of the matter is that we tax capital too much. We tax it through high capital gains taxes. We tax it through a high corporate income tax rate. And the studies that we see around the world is that the best way to get growth is not through more government spending, but through tax cuts aimed at stimulating business investment. And that's what we're about. And I think the Republicans commit the sin of simply saying, oh, let's just cut taxes and everything will be all right. It's more complicated.
But if you're concerned about the deficit, as you both are, and that was the number one issue in the election, according to most Tea Party adherents, wouldn't restoring the Bush tax cuts for the top 1% explode the deficit by $700 billion
over 10 years?
That's what
it's
the opponents
$700 billion over 10 years. Let's call it $70 billion a year with a deficit of $1.4 trillion. I mean, the truth is we have two choices in the country. We can either accept the president's spending levels headed toward 25% of GDP, then we need to repeal all of the Bush tax cuts and then some, or we can bring down the size of government and have a more rational tax system. Those are the only two choices. The president likes to parse it out because it sounds good, but there's no economics there.
And the bigger picture here is that if you look at the deficit, the tendency is to simply focus on one side, which is the basically cut expenditures and raise taxes, when what we're saying is that if you the best way to balance the budget and have growth is to have a strong investment sector where we're creating jobs. If we move from a 2.4% growth rate, which we've had over the last decade, to a 3.2% growth rate, which is our full potential output, we'll increase jobs over the decade by 10 million, and we'll increase government revenue substantially, and everything will look rosy like it did in the last few years of the Clinton years. So growth is the best budget balancer.
But how long would that take? I mean, I've interviewed Newt Gingrich.
That's a funny question, Brian, because we in this country suffer from ADD. We just want things to happen tomorrow, and this is going to take some time. But it took us some time to get into it.
How long?
Well,
cutting the tax rates.
I'm an optimist on this in the sense that I do think after the Deficit Commission reports, and President Obama, I'm sure, will want to take a leadership position here, there are ways to articulate a plan for longer-term cuts in government spending, particularly in Social Security, which is easier than Medicare and Medicaid. And I think that opens up the room to have a very large and rich budget discussion. I think that conversation can happen quickly. The pain does not have to be all now. It can be spread out over a period of time. But I do expect that conversation to begin in the next 2 years.
Let me get one more call in for you. Glenn Hubbard and Peter Navarro, authors of Seeds of Destruction, Why the Path to Economic Ruin Runs Through Washington and How to Reclaim American Prosperity. And then we have New Jersey's newest congressman, John Runyon. Yes, that John Runyon, standing by. Kelly in Bayside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I think this is all well and good, but I think in 10 years, China really is just going to be the superpower. The U.S. won't, and there's not much we can do to stop it. There's nothing that China needs from the U.S. They've teamed up with India and with Africa. The only thing they need from the U.S. is to loan us money, and the only people that benefit from that are the investors. Nothing's going to change until the average American stops buying products like from Disney that are made in China. And I think that's the real issue.
Guys, last question.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated. I think what Americans, all of us, need to do is, I think you hinted, pivoting away from consumption toward other kinds of economic activity. But China is running a great many risks. There were stories, a generation ago that Japan would eat our lunch. That did not happen. The Japanese economic system and financial system had its own seeds of destruction, as does China in it. So I think the jury is very much out. This is a play we can fix.
Glenn Hubbard, Dean of the Columbia University Business School and a member of the Bush Administration economic team, and Peter Navarro, a business professor at UC Irvine, who once ran for Congress as a Democrat. They have combined forces for a sort of a center-right economic critique of Obama administration economic policy and other things in their new book, Seeds of Destruction, Why the Path to Economic Ruin Runs Through Washington and How to Reclaim American Prosperity. We really appreciate you joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you.
Take care, Glenn.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and yes, former Philadelphia Eagle and now Congressman-elect John Runyon of New Jersey in a minute.